Thank you very much for that introduction, Barbara. It's a real pleasure to be here and to address the group. And I think following on from the previous presentation, which obviously fits probably very well with the Fields Institute, I'm obviously coming from a slightly different perspective, and I'll have to admit up front, I don't think I have one equation in my whole presentation, so hopefully, I have lots of pictures though. So what I thought I would do today is give an overview of some of the work that we're doing at the University of Calgary in the area of positioning and navigation. And what I hope to do is give you some perspective of how this particular system came to be. What are the requirements? What's really driving sort of the work in positioning and navigation? What are users really expecting from the system? And then I'm going to talk about some of the work that we're doing, everything from high accuracy positioning at the few centimeter level to some emerging areas like indoor positioning and other applications. And then I'll close with a look to the future as to where things are going. Of course, math is the foundation for everything we do, so I will touch sort of as we go at some of the mathematical aspects that we're interested in. So the Global Positioning System, GPS, many of us think of as a new system. In fact, I've been working in this system for over 20 years, so it's new in the sense that a lot of the sort of public has become aware of the system. They've had it maybe in a rental car, or they maybe bought one for hiking or sailing. But it was actually conceived back in the late 60s. So the system itself, from a technology point of view, is actually relatively old, and that provides some challenges to where things are headed to the future. No surprise, similar to things like the internet, it has sort of a basis or a foundation coming from the military. GPS was actually conceived back in the late 60s, started to be worked on more seriously in the 70s, and it was really driven by the U.S. military as a means to provide a navigation capability to its troops. There was a predecessor to this system, a satellite-based navigation system called Transit, which was sort of operated and led by the U.S. Navy, but it had a number of limitations. One of the things that they really wanted to achieve with GPS is an instantaneous positioning capability. And what that means is you turn on your GPS receiver and you can determine location as defined by latitude, longitude, and height virtually instantaneously. Previous systems relied on tracking the satellites as they go over their orbit for a period of time, accumulating measurements to be able to solve the system of equations. So what really was the foundation then to make the instantaneous positioning capability possible is keeping precise time in space. So that was absolutely critical. And of course, there were a number of experiments early on to be able to look at clock or oscillator technology, launching that in space, and to ensure that time could be kept relatively stable in space, because one of the underlying principles of GPS is that all of the satellites in space which have clocks on board are more or less synchronized to one another, not perfectly, but more or less. So the system, first satellite launched in 78. It was supposed to be sort of fully operational. That means all satellites up there working 24/7 by about 83, 84. I actually first came into contact with the system in the summer of 83. A number of things happened, sort of political issues. The first satellites were launched by rocket. Then they wanted to switch to the space shuttle. We had the space shuttle disaster. They went back to rocket. So a number of delays, meaning that the system wasn't actually fully capable until about 1995. And that's why you've seen sort of in the last maybe 5-10 years a lot of discussion and use of the technology, because it is operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The system cost, and I'm kind of guessing here, well over $50 billion. And the question is, who's paying for it? The U.S. taxpayers are paying for it. This system is free of charge for all users, so it's not like a cell system, mobile system, or cellular telephones where you're paying a monthly fee. In this case, if you buy your GPS receiver, you go out, turn it on, you can have free access to the signals. That policy is not going to change anytime soon. It would be very hard to manage. So system cost is very, very high. And, of course, what that means is once the infrastructure is in place, it's kind of difficult to change because there's been so much investment. And what has happened, of course, and it's been quite interesting, is that even though the system has its roots in the military and obviously is very important for military operations, the number of users on the civilian side far outweighs the number of military users. And in terms of policy on the system, that's what's really driving the need to modernize. So there's a lot of work being done right now to improve GPS, the type of signals being transmitted, the structure of those signals, and so on and so forth. So the military have access to certain signals that we do not, but believe me, if you look at innovation, there's a lot more innovation really happening on the commercial side, coming from some of the new requirements that really makes this quite interesting. So the system consists nominally of 24. Right now there are 28 satellites in space orbiting 20,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface, traveling about 4 kilometers per second, takes about 12 hours to go through their orbit. You can see there are 6 orbital planes here, denoted in red. Effectively, the satellites form a cage around the Earth, operating continuously. So again, global system, it works relatively the same anywhere you are on Earth, be it the North Pole, be it in Toronto, or be it in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. There are a number of caveats to that, which I'll talk about later. But effectively, the system is up there. There aren't times when they're kind of switching the switch off to say, sorry, you're not getting GPS today. It's really been ingrained into our everyday lives, and I'll talk a little bit about that. If you look at the commercial value of GPS as a technology and its impact in society, it is measured in the billions. So the question is, what is actually transmitted from space? So those signals are transmitting on 2 carrier frequencies. So these carrier frequencies carry information, if you will, and one very significant piece of information is what we call a code. It's a pseudo-random noise code. Every satellite transmits a unique identifier, if you will, that identifies what satellite it's coming from. The code structures, there's 2 types. There's a CA code, a course acquisition code, and a P code. This course acquisition code repeats itself every millisecond on this carrier, has a wavelength of about, the CA code, 293 meters. And it is publicly available. So if you were a company and you wanted to build a GPS receiver, you'd get a document that would say satellite 23 will generate a code that looks like this, and you would basically program that into your receiver such that when you know these signals arrive from space, you could identify what satellite it's coming from. The other code, the precise code, is open as well, but it is encrypted. So when we talk about what the military have access to, there's a level of encryption on these P codes that we don't know what that is, and it means that these are not sort of openly accessible by the civilian community. So basically there's 2 important pieces of information that come from the satellites. One is the carrier information itself, and the other is the coding information. And I'll talk very briefly about what that means in terms of measurements, because at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is define a location. Another piece of information that is transmitted on the signals is what's called a navigation message. And what that does is it tells us where the satellites are in space. So there are a number of stations around the Earth that are monitored again and by the U.S. Air Force. They are tracking these satellites. They know where they are. They predict forward 24 hours in time where the satellites will be located. That gets uploaded to the satellite and, again, transmitted back down to us as users. The accuracy at which they can predict those orbits are in real time is about 2 to 5 meters. In post-mission groups, and again, this is an area of study, they look at orbital determination, and they can, using data over a period of time, know where those satellites are down to about 5 centimeters. So the system, you'll see there are these 2 signals. Why did they transmit on 2 signals? One of the reasons is to calibrate out the effect from the ionosphere, which is an upper layer of the atmosphere. The signals are dispersive at these frequencies, so the effect of the ionosphere will be different at different frequencies, more significant at the lower frequencies. So they transmit on 2 frequencies, so that can effectively be removed. From a civilian point of view, this created a lot of, and still does, a lot of interesting work around having measurements of different frequencies and how you can utilize that to get more accurate positioning and so on and so forth. The system is going through a modernization. The 2 signals aren't really good enough, particularly this L2 signal is not at a protected frequency. And one of the drivers for GPS into the future is using it for landing civilian aircraft. They don't want to be using frequencies that could be open to interference and other things. So there's a new frequency that is going to be incorporated into new generation satellites, the first of which will be launched in hopefully 2005, and that is called L5. So we will have a new frequency added, and we will have a very interesting code structure, which I won't get into, on that new satellite to try to mitigate some of the errors. Those are used for different things. Actually, L3 is used for sort of detection of nuclear activity, which is not part of positioning and navigation. So these satellites have other capabilities beyond positioning and navigation. Just to kind of as an interesting point, effectively what gets done at the satellite side is these codes get generated as a series of ones and zeros, and again, it's called pseudo-random, but there is a definite pattern to those code structures. You have the carrier, which is either at that L1 or L2 frequency, and what they do is, using a biphase modulation, is overlay the codes on the carrier, and this modulated carrier is what gets transmitted by the satellite, and you can see that every time there's a switch from a 0 to a 1 or 1 to a 0, you get a 180-degree phase shift. So this is what gets transmitted from the satellite. The receiver will receive that information, and it effectively undoes this back to a code and a carrier. And it's using these two measurements, if you will, that we can actually determine our location. And just to let you know how the coding actually works, again, you get transmitted a code from the satellite. The receiver knows what the code. It continually generates the code for every satellite that is in view. And what it does is it uses an autocorrelation function to be able to shift the code that it is generating in time to match up to the received code. Of course, that shift, why is there going to be a shift? Due to the actual transit or amount of time it has taken for that satellite signal to arrive at the receiver, due to the Doppler frequency, due to the atmospheric effects, and so on and so forth. So it's making a measurement of that time shift, and that is what we call our pseudo range. One of the problems you get into is that because you're measuring a time shift, and because I said all these satellite clocks are synchronized, well, they are more or less. They're not synchronized with the clock inside the receiver that is actually making this time shift measurement. So you have another parameter, unknown quantity in there, which is a time error of the receiver relative to the satellite. So that's why it's called a pseudo range and not a direct range. Now, how does it work? Well, we can use either these code measurements or pseudo range measurements or the carrier phase measurements to determine location. And from a very simplistic way, of course, what we're trying to do is look at the intersection of those pseudo ranges to determine a location using a concept called trilateration. But from a mathematical point of view, we use least squares, we use common filtering or other types of estimation techniques to make that happen. What's interesting, of course, is that probably quite obvious from here, GPS is a four-dimensional system in the sense that it not only provides latitude, longitude, and height, or XYZ, it also provides a measure of precise time. So if you look at the world's timekeeping or time transfer, GPS is a critical component in that process. And we don't actually do research on that, but it is important for things like banking or financial transactions, power management and usage, and so on and so forth. So nominally, you need at least four satellites, obviously, to solve your system of equations. But if you go outside and you turn on your GPS receiver, generally speaking, you're going to have observed in open sky conditions maybe 10 satellites above maybe a 5-degree local horizon. So there's a lot of redundancy. This is very important, of course, from a user point of view, because one of the areas of work which is very critical in GPS is what we call integrity monitoring. You have to know, if you're going to use the system for safety of life applications, if there are significant errors in any one of these measurements. So you don't want a uniquely defined system with just four satellites observable. You have no redundancy, and it would be virtually impossible to determine if any one of those actually have an error. So having redundancy and being able to determine errors in any one of those measurements is absolutely critical, and there's a whole body of work around what we call integrity monitoring. Now, one of the questions I often get asked is, how accurate is GPS? Well, the accuracy of our location is a function of basically two things. One is, of course, how accurate those ranging measurements are. And there are a number of factors that I will talk about that impact that accuracy. And the other is the satellite geometry, which is effectively encapsulated in a design matrix or cosine matrix that actually shows you the vectors between the satellite antenna and the satellite. So the geometry then is defined of what satellites you're observing and where they are in the sky. So users, what do they want? They want high accuracy everywhere. GPS is a line of sight system. So the signals that are transmitted from the satellites are very weak. It was never designed to work in anything but basically open sky conditions. If you look at some of the emerging applications, people want to use it in very tough environments, and theoretically they want to be using it indoors, and that's a real challenge, which I'll talk about. We like to say accuracy is addictive. So if I tell you you can get 5 meters, you'll think of 10 things you could do with the system. But if I told you you could get a meter, you'd think of probably 20 more and centimeters and so on and so forth. So in terms of signal quality, things obviously, if you've got large buildings, you can have complete blockage of the signal. Or you could have, if you're in an urban environment, for example, stepping outside here, you could have the reflection of the signals off buildings, and we call that multiple paths. Similarly, if the signal is transmitting around trees with or without foliage, you're going to have some attenuation of your signal, and you're going to have some errors associated with that. Similarly, if you have a lot of solar activity that heats up the ionosphere, again, you're going to have some problems with that. So if you're talking about using GPS in the auroral region, the northern lights, you could have problems where you're not going to track the satellites necessarily very well. You're not going to get measurements. You're not going to get a position. You can have a lot of interference on the signal. So you could have somebody either voluntarily or not transmitting signals that are close to the GPS frequencies and disturbing the system and the reception of signals. Each one of these is itself an area of study. Now, the one I don't have up here is the troposphere, but I'll talk about that in a little bit later. So there, for example, some of the research that we do is looking at theoretical modeling of each one of these phenomena. Because if I can reduce the effect of the ionosphere from my measurements, I'm going to have more accurate measurements, I'm going to have more accurate positions. Similarly, if I can detect the presence of interference, which is a real issue, particularly we do a lot of work with the military, again, I'm going to have better measurements, better positions. Same with multipath. Some of our work is around looking at techniques to be able to model multipath and to be able to, again, utilize that to remove it from our measurements. These are systematic errors. Basically, in our mathematics, we like to think of all our errors being randomly distributed. Not the case. These throw a lot of problems into our data. So there's a lot of work done in each of these as a field of study. So the one thing is the accuracy of our measurements. Secondly is the geometry. Obviously, from a mathematical point of view, you want your satellites well spaced, various quadrants of the sky. But it's on the right-hand side, if you're in an urban area where you're going through what we call an urban canyon, where you have large buildings, there's potential that you're only tracking satellites in certain parts of the sky, you have poor geometry. So if you get down to 4 or 5 satellites in some cases, depending on where they're located, that may be cause a real problem in terms of the achievable accuracy. So in terms of accuracy, what do we get? Well, if you just go buy a GPS receiver off the shelf and you take it outside, open sky, you're going to get 5 meters pretty easily, maybe 10, but generally speaking, we're seeing 5 or a little bit better. Up until the year 2000, you would be getting accuracies on the order of tens of meters, maybe 100 meters. That was because the U.S. military actually put some errors, intentional errors, into the system to cause a degradation. That was turned off in 2000, and we can discuss later why that was. But now you're getting pretty good accuracy. And again, this is virtually irrespective of your location, assuming, again, open sky. What if you want better than that? Well, effectively what we can do, because our errors are highly spatially correlated, at least a number of them are, so if we have measurements coming from the satellite transmitting through the same parts of the atmosphere, obviously two receivers that are relatively close together are going to sense the same errors, and it's going to be able to be calibrated out. So if we put a GPS receiver at what we call a reference station, where we know its location, we can effectively determine what the errors are. We can, by differencing the observed position or computed position with respect to the known location, and then we can transmit that information to users. They would correct their measurements and be able to determine a relative location quite easily, down to a few meters, probably 0.5 to 2 meters, using these pseudo-range measurements. If you want to get better than that, you go to these carrier wave measurements, and you can ultimately get a few centimeters. Mathematically, it's not that difficult to do, but what makes it extremely challenging is dealing with a lot of these systematic errors I talked about previously. To make it happen reliably and to have a level of availability, that means working a high percentage of the time, is a real challenge, and there's a lot of work being done in that area. So what drives what? Well, we come up with new location technologies, user requirements obviously start to get keyed up. They want more, driving new applications, new technologies, and so on and so forth. So as I say, accuracy is addictive, although accuracy for many applications isn't the primary driver. For safety of life applications such as landing an aircraft, integrity of the system is absolutely critical. It's okay if it doesn't work, but the pilot needs to know so he or she can make alternative decisions before it's too late. So high accuracy, a lot of our work over the years has focused on what we call the centimeter level positioning. And you would say, well, why do we need to know where anything is to a few centimeters? You'd be surprised at the applications, and I'll talk about some of them. It is a real challenge. If we look at positioning with these so-called carrier phase measurements, from a mathematical point of view, there is in these measurements what's called an ambiguity. So the receiver effectively measures the difference in phase between the incoming signal and a replicated carrier wave, but there's an integer number of cycles with a wavelength of 19 centimeters that is unknown. They're basically nuisance parameters, but until we know the exact number of these integer ambiguity, if we don't know the exact number, our range is going to be off by 19 centimeters or 38 centimeters or whatever the case may be. So there's a lot of work done in what we call ambiguity resolution, and particularly, again, with data with systematic errors. So it is a real challenge. What are some of the applications? Well, we're doing some work right now with the U.S. Navy where they want to land aircraft and aircraft carriers autonomously. So that means pilots hands off. And effectively, you know how an aircraft lands on an aircraft carrier. It has a tail hook, and the idea is to be able to hook into one of the wires that actually goes across the deck. There are four of them, and you don't want to get to the fourth and not be connected on, because that could be trouble. They want to do positioning at the level of about 30 centimeters to make this happen. And you can imagine, this is very tough. These aircraft are going through some pretty high dynamics. The aircraft carrier is moving, so we actually have to be involved in doing modeling of the motion of the carrier, because you obviously want it to be able to land on the deck. You've got a lot of potential interference, because these are going to be operating in perhaps an area where you've got a lot of other electronics on the go, or you have threats from perhaps the enemy, and they could be trying to jam or upset your system. So it's a huge problem. We're the only group outside of the United States working on this, working with other universities and companies and so on, multi-year, hundreds of millions of dollar project. Of course, we're a small component of that, but what expertise we bring in is on the precise positioning. Another interesting application is where we put GPS antennas on the wingtips of an aircraft, and we can actually use that to measure the amount of flexure and movement in the wings. And that's what I'm just plotting here. Is you see a sort of a step function. That's when the aircraft took off, and we measured the vertical motion of those wings, and you can see it flexed about 12 centimeters during flight, came back when the aircraft landed. So measuring things in a very precise way is possible with GPS. One of the things that is a problem, though, is that, again, it works well in open sky conditions. What happens if I wanted to position a vehicle in downtown Toronto? Not going to be possible because of all of the problems around blockage. So what do? We integrate with other sensors. So a lot of our work is around sensor integration, looking at what each navigation sensor can provide and what are the optimal techniques from a mathematical point of view to extract that information and marry them the best way we can. So one sensor that is used quite often is what's called an inertial measurement unit, or sometimes an inertial navigation system. And effectively, this is a self-contained device that measures 3D acceleration, or more specifically, specific force, and angular rate. So it's a dead reckoning system. It will tell you which direction you're going and a vector from an initial starting point. It's a very nice complementary navigation technology to GPS. One can kind of mitigate the errors of the other. And what's happening, these again come from a military perspective, but these are getting much smaller, much cheaper, and you can buy off the shelf now MEMS-based sensors, which we're doing a lot of work on. So integrating these two, and the idea is when GPS is available, it's going to tell you where you are very accurately. But if you're not, if you're lost GPS, this is going to fill in the gaps. So there's a lot of work done then on system integration. And we have actually designed a system to position vehicles down to a few centimeters. And you may say, well, why do we want to know that? Well, again, if you look at things like vehicle stability control systems and looking at for safety aspects, if the vehicle knows where it is very accurately, and if it's skidding or whatever, it can start making intelligent decisions about what it has to do. So in our test vehicle, we have our inertial unit bolted on the bottom. We have our GPS antenna on the top. We have a radio because we're actually receiving these differential information in real time. So up in the roof of our building, we have another GPS receiver antenna on a known location transmitting data to the vehicle, and it's doing positioning at the few centimeter level. So what are we trying to do? What we're trying to do is say, well, if I have an outage in GPS, I know prior to this time I can position my vehicle down to a few centimeters, but let's say I go through a tunnel, lose GPS, I still want to know where I am to centimeters. I'm going to now start relying on my inertial system, and what I want is for that error growth to be very small. Now, that error growth is going to be directly related to the quality of the sensor. So you can see in this case, if I had an outage of 10 seconds, I would be positioning still down to about 20 centimeters or so. But once I get up to 30, 40 seconds in this with this particular sensor, I'm off by a few meters. So what we're working on is better modeling to try to reduce this slope. Where is this going? We're doing some work right now with Toyota out of Japan, where they're very interested in centimeter level positioning of a vehicle. So we're taking what we're doing here using an inertial system and GPS, but we're also looking at sensors that are already on board the vehicle. So if you buy a vehicle these days, there are a number of things like gyros, accelerometers that are integrated into the vehicle for many different functions. So what we're doing is we're working with them. We bought a Toyota vehicle, tried to get a Lexus, but that didn't work, and getting the data off these sensors and integrating it in with GPS. So it's a very interesting project, and what they're trying to do is extend this time at which we can do the centimeter level when GPS is not available. Another application of high accuracy, we've done a lot of work with the Canadian Coast Guard, where they're looking at precise positioning of ships through the St. Lawrence Seaway, very important shipping corridor for Canada. And what they're interested in is increasing the amount of cargo that goes on the vessel. And of course, the more cargo that goes on, the more this ship is going to sink. The current requirements is that the underkeel clearance must be at least 60 centimeters. So you can imagine they need to dredge every spring, they need to know the tides very accurately, and they would need to know that height relatively accurately. So you can imagine if they want to push it below that, they need to know the height of this vessel, not only to a few centimeters, but again, very reliably, and that's where the tough part is. Similarly, this is not the CN Tower, but the Calgary Tower, and our sort of humble replica, if you will. You can put GPS on structures. I talked about the wing flexure. We actually had a graduate student volunteer to go to the top of the tower, put a GPS receiver up there, and was able to measure the amount of motion of this structure, again, to a few centimeters in either direction. So it's used a lot of bridges and other structures to be able to measure motion for safety and other aspects. Okay, so one of the new things that is coming up is what we call indoor GPS. Why do we want to do location indoors? The first reason why there was a lot of attention paid to this is for what we call E911, which is Enhanced 911. This is being mandated by the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, whereby if you have a cellular telephone and you dial 911, they want to be able to locate you to about 100 meters 67% of the time. Of course, now they can locate you within a cell site. They would know which cell sites you're using, but to get down to the level of accuracy, current techniques are not sufficient. So what's happening is, and there are a number of technologies that can be used for this, but the one that's kind of winning out is GPS in cell phones, where they integrate the GPS receiver into the cellular telephone to be able to provide that capability. There are 2 million GPS handsets shipped per month in 2003. So it is increasing significantly. There is some initial capability for this in Canada, but a lot in Japan and in the United States it's being rolled out quite significantly. The other aspect is what we call location-based services. Again, many of you are probably familiar with the GPS in cars. Well, transport that system in a car to a cell phone or a PDA, and you would be able to navigate to the nearest Starbucks or ATM or whatever the case may be. So a lot of interest in what we call location-based services. Now, this is a huge problem because, as I just said, GPS works great outdoors. Once you start going indoors, obviously you have shading where you just not are blocking. You're not going to receive the signal at all. You could have, if it does get through a wall or a window, a lot of multipath sort of bouncing around the room. In some cases, you could receive a direct signal, and so on and so forth. So the quality of signals that you're getting indoors is obviously much weaker and much less accurate than outdoors. If I'm standing by the window, I may get some signals from satellites that way, but if I start moving towards the center of this building, signals have to go through more and more walls. So some of the work we do is actually looking at the transmission of signals through different wall types and, again, doing different levels of modeling on that. What has happened is that new GPS technology has actually been developed called high-sensitivity GPS receivers. So these are the ones that will go in the cell phones and PDAs, and effectively they just dwell longer, so it's sort of a signal processing exercise where if you've got weak signals and you integrate over longer periods of time, you're going to drive up the signal strength. So they could dwell for hundreds of milliseconds as opposed to a standard GPS receiver, which is typically less than 10. And so what you're hoping to do then is by dwelling longer, you're increasing the signal strength and being able to do positioning in these environments. You can't put a receiver like this on a fighter aircraft. The dynamics are too high. So one of the things we do then is testing of these technologies both indoors and different environments, again, to try to model things as well as on a simulator which can simulate RF signals. We would hook a GPS receiver up to it, simulate a weak signal environment, and then be able to look at how the receiver can actually track and acquire. These receivers have to be initialized or acquire the GPS satellites outside, and then you can move inside. The acquisition part is very tough. Once you acquire, you can move inside, and generally speaking, you're going to be able to track the satellites. This is just some data from inside, actually, our garage. So we volunteered our garage to the graduate student. I told them their experiment would work much better if they cleaned the garage first, but they didn't pay much attention to me. But what you can see here is a scatter plot of the easting and northing, and each one of those blue dots is a fix. It's a position. The red dot is the truth of where the antenna really was. So what you're seeing here is, yeah, you're actually getting positions indoors, but it's pretty noisy. It's not that great. It's not down to that, few meter level. What would be an application for this? Firefighters would love it. Let's say you send a firefighter into a building, smoky, you don't know where they are. They've got a system on them that can actually transmit back to someone else where they're located. Obviously, that's going to be of high usage. What is the next step beyond that is what we call assisted GPS. So we're doing a lot of work in this area as well, where you can actually use the cell system to aid you. So if you put a GPS receiver by a cell site and it was in the open, it would know what satellites are available, where those satellites are in the sky, what the Doppler shift is going to be, and so on and so forth. It can, through the cell network, transmit that to a user such as yourself using a cell phone. So the mobile or user would receive that information, and having that good a priori information as to where the satellites are in the sky, and again their Doppler, it can acquire at lower levels of signal strength. So that's what we call assisted GPS. So we have students that are actually doing a lot of analysis of this assisted GPS in using simulation, using field data, and coming up with a representation of the level of ability to acquire using different types and different accuracies of assistance data. Where we're headed with this is we've actually built a GPS receiver in software rather than hardware. So part of our research is looking at new tracking algorithms that we can, as a research institution, put in software relatively easily. We can't build all the hardware, that would take a long time, but actually looking at new techniques for acquisition and tracking. And just to give you an idea, this is some simulated data where we start at a relatively high signal strength, although it's minus 160 dBW for anybody who's familiar with that. But then we start decreasing the power level, and what you're seeing on the upper charts are the errors in position. And you can see that they're pretty good at a few meter level. And then as the power starts decreasing more and more, you can see effectively the spread gets much higher, and you see at some point they actually stop tracking. So I won't go through the details, but what this was designed to look at are different receiver technologies and how they would react to these different weak signal environments. Okay, so what else is coming on the future? Well, let's turn the whole thing around. I've been talking so far about using GPS to determine location. The other thing we can actually do is use GPS as a sensing tool. So, for example, if you know your location already, what you can use GPS for is being able to interpret the propagation path of the signal. And the one that has a lot of interest right now is actually using GPS for meteorology. So using it to be able to make a measure of the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. So what we have done for this is we've actually established a network around Calgary of GPS receivers that are permanently collecting data, some of them transmitting data to our university in real time. These have a spacing of about 30 to 50 kilometers. At each location, we have a GPS receiver. We have an antenna up in the top of the building, and what we're hoping to do is use data from all of these stations to be able to model what the water vapor is doing over this region. And this is an interesting area. Of course, we have the Rocky Mountains here, and there are a lot of interesting weather patterns that start in the Rockies and move eastward. And this is just showing, in one case, a storm formation that is starting. So we've done experiments looking at using GPS for water vapor estimation. In fact, one of my former PhD students, who is now a colleague, has a background in space physics, and she brings obviously a very interesting perspective in really leading this type of work. So what we're trying to do then is make measurements from all these GPS units and have us tell us what the slant wet delay is, and you can see in this vertical scale, or perhaps you can't, it's measured from 0 to about 9 centimeters, decreasing as a function of elevation. So what it's saying is, depending on where that satellite is, if it's at a low elevation, the signals are traveling through more of the atmosphere, it's going to be delayed more by the water vapor compared to higher elevation satellites. And effectively what we're using GPS for, because we're constraining the position, is determining what that wet delay is. What we would do is actually give this information to a meteorologist. They would put it in as part of their numerical weather prediction model, in with other data as well, and try to improve weather prediction. On the right-hand side, I'm showing you what's called a water vapor radiometer, which is an independent measurement that gives us the so-called truth. A few things. This is more historical research we've done, GPS and farming. The idea here is to make farming more productive. So we put GPS on a combine. We also put a yield monitor on the combine. And the idea is, as the farmer is harvesting, they're measuring the amount of yield and recording that on a computer along with location, such that at the end of the day, they get a color-coded map of the productivity of the field. Different colors obviously reflect things like differences in soil, differences in the amount of salinity, amount of humidity in the soil, and so forth. So this is interesting, but what's the farmer going to do with that? Well, they work with the agriculturalist to come up with what's called a prescription map, which would say, rather than putting the same amount and same type of, say, nitrogen everywhere in the field, let's vary it as a function of location. That's called the prescription map. That gets programmed into the computer. In the springtime, you've got the prescription map on a computer. You've got GPS. Once you know where you are in the field, it would look at the map, determine what should be applied, send that signal back to the variable rate fertilizer, and it would apply the right amount and right type of fertilizer as a function of location. These systems are commercially available, and many farmers and large farms throughout North America and beyond are actually using this technology. Where things are going now is to automate the process. Again, if you can do positioning down to a few centimeters, theoretically, there doesn't have to be somebody in the cab. So that's where things are headed there. We've done a lot of early work in this 10 years ago. Tracking. So asset tracking, be it kids, husbands, animals. There are a number of collars that have been developed to track wildlife. And wildlife, I'm including my children in that. But putting them on animals to study migration patterns and so on and so forth. These are getting smaller and smaller. In fact, we're doing some work with cattle. So, for example, if you had a small, lightweight, low-power consumption tag that had GPS, you could put it on maybe every cow's ear. You would be able to track it from birth to wherever it ends up at the end of the day. And that's really important because if you look at things like BSE, obviously you want early detection. So you could have a system, for example, that has some intelligence around it where you're knowing the location of the animal, you're knowing whether or not it's moving. If an animal is sick and doesn't, it tends not to move very much, you would be able to identify that. So if you had a huge feedlot, you could track each one of your cows and know which ones are actually moving, which ones are being quite stationary. You could have other sensors to measure temperature and other things and come up with sort of a smart decision-making system to be able to manage through things like BSE and other phenomena. Also, GPS is being used for things like helping with Alzheimer's patients, blind people, and so on. We don't do research per se in this, but one of the outcomes of our research is a lot of software. We commercialize a lot of the techniques that we've developed, and they get integrated into software, and companies license our software and build applications around it. So we have been doing this for almost, 13 to 15 years, and our software is being used in over 200 agencies worldwide. So there's a company in Ontario that is actually using our software in with their collars to do sort of the positioning component with it. So what's the future? Well, one thing that's coming downstream, which is very interesting, is a new satellite navigation system. I talked about the fact that GPS is being modernized. There'll be new signals and new interesting signal structures added. The Europeans are developing their own system called Galileo. It will consist of 30 satellites. So what we'll have down the road is not 28, but close to 60. Again, it'll have some very interesting signal structures. They've learned from GPS what are the benefits, what are the things that perhaps have been restrictions. And they're launching their system hopefully to be complete by 2008. Most people think by 2010. In Canada, we've done a lot of work in Galileo looking at new tracking techniques that we're patenting. And geopolitically, we're in an interesting position. We do a lot of work with the United States, both with military and companies. But we're also through the Canadian Space Agency, an associate member of ESA, so we have ties into Europe as well. So what are we going to see with GPS Galileo? As I say, well, we're going to have close to 60 satellites. So by 2010, when you buy a satellite navigation receiver, it'll probably be tracking both systems. They will operate independently, but they will be interoperable. So they'll be compatible with one another, but they will be fully independent. One of the reasons why the Europeans have pushed ahead for their own system is for sovereignty. Issues like landing aircraft based on a system controlled by the U.S. Department of Defense wasn't making them feel overly comfortable, and they wanted to develop their own industry. They really got left behind with GPS. Canada is actually the second largest exporter of GPS technology behind the United States. Europe didn't really develop a significant industry, a homegrown industry, and Galileo is going to provide them the capability of doing that. Just to give you an example, what you get when you put the two systems together, this is effectively showing you sort of the geometry, if you will, which is a unitless number, but it ties into performance. And what you're the lower the number, the better. And what you're seeing here is all blue. So if you have GPS only and you have a 10-degree mask angle, that means you can observe everything above 10 degrees local horizon. You don't have any problems. You've got good geometry. It's all blue. What happens when you have a 30-degree mask angle? So you're trying to use GPS in an urban area, and you can't see anything below 30 degrees. So you're looking at the higher satellites. What happens to your geometry? You get these bands of yellows and reds, which means it's getting quite weak. Your positions aren't going to be nearly as accurate. What happens at 30 degrees if I combine GPS and Galileo? I have nearly 60 satellites. That gets mitigated. So from a user perspective, this is all good stuff. So we do a lot of work on what happens when you put these two systems together. What are the new mathematical techniques that you can use? What's going to impact on our performance and so on and so forth. The other thing that's happening, and I'm just touching on a few things, is GPS is getting smaller, and a GPS receiver now is as small as a sort of a thumbnail, the ones that go in cellular telephones. Similarly, you'll have these other MEMS-based sensors that are getting very small and much higher performance. So you can get into things like the pedestrian navigation, cell phones, and so on, but give better performance. So we do work, again, for indoors where even this assisted GPS isn't that great. You still want to marry it with complementary technologies. And on these little squares here, these are things like accelerometers that are very small and give a very good complementary performance to GPS. So a lot of what we're working on is sensor integration, sensor modeling, error modeling, to be able to improve performance. So in summary, the requirements haven't stopped. They get more stringent. Expectations from the community increase. Research is ongoing to improve performance, accuracy, reliability, integrity, availability. Novel applications are constantly emerging. I certainly can't keep track of all of them. And they're fascinating because a lot of the core technology and algorithms are sort of constant across these applications, but then you start looking at, well, GPS in cars or GPS on aircraft and GPS in space. I haven't even talked about that. And really, it makes the field very interesting because you're in contact with all of these different communities. What are we going to see for the future? New systems. The Japanese are actually launching a sort of a smaller scale system. So lots on the horizon, and both from a theoretical point of view, our students are involved in everything from theoretical development through to application development. We're going to see a lot of improvements, and for all of us as users, I think that's just going to be a benefit down the road. So I will stop there and be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you. Transmitters. Well, okay, so they're actually, the system that they want to replace is such a system you're talking about called a microwave landing system, where they have local infrastructure at the airport that provides a local positioning capability. So as you fly in relative to that microwave landing system. The cost of installing that type of a system on an aircraft, at an airport is horrendous. And I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it's extremely expensive. And obviously, they only have them at limited airports where they can justify the cost, so some of the very large airports. So part of it is they're looking at a more cost-effective structure. Now, I don't want to oversimplify how easy it is to land an aircraft with GPS. The integrity issues are huge. We don't actually do a lot of work in the commercial side. Stanford is very big in that area. They will look at redundant systems, so they're not going to say buy a handheld GPS receiver from Mountain Equipment Co-op and throw it in the aircraft and start landing it. A lot of work. I mean, in terms of stringent requirements, it's the toughest that's out there. Now, in terms of what the access requirements are, they aren't 10 centimeters. You're right, you don't want to be off 10 centimeters, but at some point, and it depends on the category type of landing, but even the most stringent doesn't require 10 centimeters, because it is different than the aircraft carrier case, because they are landing on a tarmac. But at some point, when they get close, there will be a visual, if you will. So the actual requirements are at the sub-meter level, I think about 60 centimeters or so, maybe at 95%. So they're not a few centimeters, but they are very stringent, and a huge amount of work being done, like things like multipath, huge. But what they will have at the airport is a local differential reference station, so they'll be tracking those errors that are locally significant and transmitting those corrections to the aircraft, and they'll be landing. It's not here yet. There's still work being done. But it will proceed, and it will happen sometime down the road. Yes.
The way you showed the example is mainly what I would call X and Y, not a lot of Z. But this is Z.
This is Z.
Right.
Yeah.
That
Z is the weaker link.
So my colleagues at the U.S. Bureau of Defense claim that they're going to be able to locate residences in apartment buildings using GPS instead of census stations. And it sounds to me like the technology isn't there yet.
No. Okay. So GPS is the four dimensions, but forgetting the time for a minute, it does provide X, Y, and Z, or we call lat, long, and height.
That's fine.
Height is the weaker link in the sense, if you look at just the satellite geometry, you've got lots of satellites above you. You don't obviously track satellites below you. So the rule of thumb is that the height component is about twice as poor as the horizontal. It's still very good. But what will be a challenge, if they think they're going to take their GPS receiver and say, okay, I'm going up the elevator to the second floor and here's my GPS coordinate. You know, you saw some of the indoor results. It's not there yet. So what they could get a good GPS position of the building, but then to extrapolate the actual height of each apartment, I mean, that it wouldn't be that difficult to do, because if you had the height of the base and you know how many feet in each floor, they could probably fairly easily compute that. But doing it indoors, there was a movie called Will Smith was in it. I can't remember it off the top of my head, where he was actually given a GPS, well, it was a package that he didn't know he had, and he was running around with it, and they were tracking him and indoor. I mean, that's not here yet. So, we kind of look at that and laugh a bit. That's where things want to go, but it's not here yet. Now, you could instrument a building to be able to position in that building, but that's very expensive infrastructure. Not going to happen in the near term for all buildings.
So these hybrid systems that you described, where it uses a combination of
Yes, I mean, there's all different sensors. You can use gyros, accelerometers, compasses, barometers, clocks. So there's all different sensors and sensor combinations you can have. And again, we typically more at a master's level, they can look at different sensors and the quality of the sensors and how you'd actually combine them to try to improve the overall availability when GPS is having problems.
I have a question about one of those world maps.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there were these orange bands across the temperature,
yeah.
Along with little bubbles